No one will blame you for feeling like it's a pretty shaky time for America. On the new podcast, How to Save a Country, you'll meet thinkers, doers, and organizers who are working to make the U.S. a more democratic and just place. People who are connecting the dots between economics, law, and politics. Hosts Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute and Michael Tomasky of the New Republic bring you the good news and the big ideas that point to a less fractured, more stable, more equal future. Follow How to Save a Country on Apple Podcasts. A milestone moment at the UN climate conference in Egypt, wealthy countries shook hands to help pay for climate-related damages in developing nations. The start of a process.
It is clearly a down payment on the longer investment in our joint futures.
Also on the show, the workday for Uber drivers in Kenya, relentless hours with low pay.
Maybe from 6 in the morning to probably 11 at night.
They're saying they've had enough and are on strike. I'm Marco Werman, and a researcher at Oxford came up with a mathematical model to predict the winner of the World Cup. But would he actually bet on that team?
I've not put any money on.
The big reveal on who he's not betting on, that and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks for joining us at the start of this holiday week. After long late-night negotiations, nearly 200 countries struck a historic deal at the UN Climate Conference in Egypt around sunrise on Sunday. The tired diplomats agreed to establish a new fund to pay for damages made worse by climate change, a big breakthrough. But negotiators did not make a lot of progress on goals for slashing greenhouse gas emissions or speeding up the transition to renewable energy. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, has been following the negotiations. Let's start with this Global Fund for Climate Damages, Carolyn. What is it exactly?
It's a fund meant to help vulnerable nations rebuild after, say, a storm that was fueled or made worse by climate change, or a slower onset event like a drought. It's seen as a historic victory for developing countries and vulnerable nations. And that's not just because of the money it will provide to help them, but because it's seen as an official recognition that poor countries with limited resources are being impacted the most by climate change, and that developed countries that have done the most to cause climate change over the years have a responsibility to help. Here's some of the reaction from those more vulnerable countries during the closing meeting of the summit early Sunday morning.
We have struggled for 30 years on this path, and today in Sharm el-Sheikh, this journey has achieved its first positive milestone.
Establishing this fund signals to the world that loss and damage will no longer solely be borne by those governments and people least responsible.
We have finally delivered climate justice. This is a defining COP in that respect.
That was Pakistan's climate minister, Sherry Rahman, the lead negotiator for the Alliance for Small Island States, Leah Nicholson, and Tuvalu's finance minister, Seve Painu.
So what do we know so far about how this fund is going to work?
Most of the details will be hammered out over the next year and finalized at the next climate summit next year. Some of the biggest questions going into this summit, other than whether this fund would be created or at all or not, were who would pay into this fund and then also who would be eligible to take out of it. And those are still relatively unanswered. Developing countries are meant to be the beneficiaries, but it's not yet clear which ones will be eligible for this sort of funding. Developed countries and other funders like international financial institutions will pay into this fund, but there's also language opening the door to countries like China, which are large current emitters, to pay in. So there's still a lot to work out here.
And Carolyn, is there any actual dollar amount that developed countries agreed to with this fund?
There's not. And I should also add the important fact that contributing to this fund will be voluntary. Developed countries do not have a stellar track record of meeting previous voluntary commitments. For example, there was a promise to fund and mobilize $100 billion of climate finance by the year 2020. Developed countries have not yet met that target and look like they won't until next year. So it's one thing to say you're going to establish a fund, and it's quite another to actually get money into it and have money start flowing out.
Okay, other than this historic agreement to create a fund, we're still waiting for details on what are the other headlines coming out of this climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh?
The other major takeaway is that not very much progress was made on tackling the root cause of climate change, slashing emissions to limit global warming in the first place. And this was the main point that the European Union's lead negotiator, Frans Timmermans, made at the closing meeting early yesterday morning.
This is the make or break decade. But what we have in front of us is not enough of a step forward for people and planet. It does not address the yawning gap between climate science and our climate policies.
So that yawning gap he's talking about, Marco, is this: even if every country delivered the emissions cuts that they've promised through the Paris Agreement process, the world is still on track for about 2.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. And that's even though the current target is to limit it to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And for context here, we're currently already at about 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming and obviously seeing some serious impacts already.
Right. There was an agreement to move away from coal at the end of the Glasgow Climate Summit last year. What did this meeting do to build on that commitment?
So that commitment to phase down unabated coal use was repeated in the agreement struck at the end of this climate summit. There was also talk during the meeting, though, about phasing down all fossil fuels, which would have been a significant step, but that did not make it into the final agreement.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, wrapping up for us the outcome of the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, this weekend. Carolyn, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
Russian and Ukrainian officials are blaming one another for intense shelling yesterday around the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia. That's in southern Ukraine. More than a dozen explosions rocked the area. The United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency is calling the attacks near Europe's biggest nuclear plant extremely disturbing. Olena Paranyuk is a nuclear power expert at the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. She joins us from the Ukrainian city of Zhytomyr, 80 miles west of Kyiv. Olena, what do we know about these latest explosions near the Zaporizhia plant? What sort of damage has been done?
So as far as we know, missiles shoot the infrastructure of Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, and they've hit some critical infrastructure that supplies energy and some critical infrastructure that controls the processes on Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Luckily, Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is in cool shutdown, yet it needs the cooling from the diesel generators and from the grid. So the equipment is crucial and essential for keeping the nuclear safety of Ukraine and the whole northern hemisphere. What is really difficult for Ukraine is that Energodar and the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant are under Russian control, and it is very difficult for Ukraine to provide some repairs to the equipment. So we don't know how it will go.
And with these attacks on the plant, what are you most worried about?
Well, of course, if something will go wrong, the whole nuclear power plant will run on diesel generators. And in case the diesel generators will go wrong, the reactors will overheat and it might lead to emission of radioactive material into the environment. The situation is that you don't only need grids, you don't only need electricity on the territory of nuclear power plant, but you also need some computing systems and some controlling systems over there. So some of the elements of those systems were broken, and we don't know how long will it take to fix them.
Top officials from the International Atomic Energy Agency, they visited the Zaporizhia plant in September. They said they were leaving at least one representative there. Did that ever happen?
Yeah, of course. There are various representatives of EAA, and they're changing each other. So that's why EAA has the information from inside the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant.
Yeah, and yet the IAEA has not been weighing in on which side has been causing damage at the plant. Doesn't that just make it really hard to prevent any escalation?
Well, IAEA claim that they're just a technical organization, which they are. Instead of the IAEA, they should be some political or diplomatic organization who should make claims. It's not the IAEA, unfortunately, and that is the trouble with the international law. There is no one who can say that it is actually Russia shooting missiles in the Ukrainian nuclear power plant.
Which, again, that makes it complicated. How much access to the plant does the IAEA team have right now?
Well, not that much. It worries me for so many reasons, because from the one hand, we want the IAEA people to be safe on the territory of Ukraine. But then from the other hand, Russia is not giving them full access. So they cannot provide the full expertise because they can see only something that they are allowed to see.
How many people should normally be on site to operate the plant?
Under normal circumstances, Zaporizhia should have 11,000 of employees. And right now they have about 3,000 employees left on the site, which is very troubling for us because a nuclear power plant is not just devices or equipment. Nuclear power plant is actually engineers who run the power plant who should take care of all of the safety measures.
Olena Paranyuk is a senior researcher at the Institute for Safety Problems of Nuclear Power Plants at the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. She joined us from the Ukrainian city of Zhytomyr, about 80 miles west of Kyiv. Olena, thanks for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Rockets are flying across the border between Turkey and Syria. Yesterday, Turkish fighter jets unleashed a barrage of airstrikes in Kurdish areas of northern Syria and Iraq. More than 24 people are reported to have been killed. Today, Kurdish militants in Syria fired rockets into Turkey, killing at least 2 people and wounding 10. Then Turkish warplanes resumed their airstrikes on northern Syria. Turkey says its initial attacks yesterday were payback for a bombing set off on a busy pedestrian street in Istanbul a week ago. Kurdish militant groups have denied involvement. The World's Duri Biskaran is in Istanbul with the latest. Duri, let's start with the border salvos this past weekend. What happened?
Right. At late Saturday night, Turkish fighter jets took off from a base in Diyarbakir to bomb rural areas in northern Syria and Iraq. Now, these are all Kurdish-majority regions where Turkey says it's targeting the PKK, a terrorist group that usually attacks Turkish government and military positions. In Iraq, the Kurdistan Regional Government said 32 PKK militants were killed. And in Syria, accurate numbers of victims are really hard to come by because there's no real central authority. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that at least one civilian activist, 16 regime soldiers, and 21 fighters from various Kurdish militias died in these attacks. They appear to have hit grain silos, a power station, and a hospital under construction. Today, the Syrian Democratic Forces launched rockets into Turkey, killing 2, including the 5-year-old nephew of a lawmaker. They also fired at a border gate, wounding several. The Syrian Democratic Forces, you might be familiar with them because they're a Kurdish-led group that's linked to the PKK, but was also backed by the United States to fight ISIS. Turkey lumps them together with the PKK and is really angry at the U.S. for continuing to support them, especially in cases like this. And they control a big part of northern Syria where this is all taking place.
Now, the Turkish government says it's retaliating for the street bombing in Istanbul that killed 6 people last week. They've already arrested an alleged attacker, so why go after 2 sovereign countries?
Very early on, the Turkish government linked its attack to last Sunday's bombing. They tweeted a picture of a jet taking off and wrote that it's hesap zamanı, or payback time. The names of 2 children killed during the Istanbul attack were even written on some of the bombs that Turkey dropped into Syria. Turkey's government doesn't see the Istanbul attack as the work of one person. They see it as the result of the PKK being allowed to flourish in northern Syria and Iraq in this kind of power vacuum that's occurred because of the wars there. I spoke to Soner Çaptay. He's a Turkey expert for the Washington Institute, and he says the bigger picture here is that Russia, which has been working with the Syrian regime, right, they control the airspace in northern Syria.
Russia seems to have allowed Turkey's air force to use certain airspace again. This has not happened for years. It also suggests that Russian President Putin knows that any hardline action and retaliation against PKK and its affiliates in Syria is not only good for Turkey's security, but will also help President Erdogan tremendously in the polls.
And that's important to Erdogan because he's facing a big election in June.
Tit-for-tat attacks, Duri, are never encouraging. What's the path forward? Is there any sign that this back and forth could end soon?
The short answer is no. Turkish President Erdogan said on a flight today that they are not done, that the airstrikes will continue with attacks on the ground. Turkey already controls border sections in northern Syria, and they seem to want more. They've done cross-border invasions like this in recent years, and this might be the beginning of another one. The U.S. hasn't said much about this yet, which Ankara might interpret as a green light. We don't know what's going on kind of behind closed doors, but it's an evolving situation and we'll be watching.
The World's Duri Biskaran reporting from Istanbul. Thanks very much, Duri.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Cut to World Cup news just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. After all the hype and controversy, the Soccer World Cup is finally underway in Qatar. The host nation faced off against Ecuador in the first match yesterday and lost 2-0, becoming the first host nation to lose the opener. In the stands, chants in Spanish from Ecuador's fans. We want beer. We want beer. A reference to Qatar's last-minute backtrack, banning beer sales at World Cup stadium sites. That brought off-field controversies right back to center stage. Yesterday, English captain Harry Kane made it clear how his team feels about wearing armbands in Qatar in support of LGBTQ rights.
I think we've made it clear as a team and an organization that we want to wear the armbands.
Soccer's governing body FIFA said players who wore them could get a penalty, so European nations decided to forego the demonstration. Today, England played Iran. During Iran's national anthem at the start of the game, the booing rained down. A moment of solidarity with anti-government activists in Iran demonstrating in support of women's rights. Something else spotted, Iran's players did not sing along when their national anthem was played. And some Iran fans had to stash their Persian flags, their symbols of people opposed to the government in Tehran. FIFA president Gianni Infantino also waded into several controversies. He raised a lot of eyebrows with his comments about history, what sounded to some critics like an attempt to absolve Qatar's dismal human rights record with immigrant workers who helped build Qatar's new stadiums.
I think for what we Europeans have been doing in the last 3,000 years around the world, we should be apologizing for the next 3,000 years.
Infantino then attempted to empathize with marginalized communities.
Today I feel gay. Today I feel disabled. Today I feel a migrant worker.
So that's what was going on off the field. Then, of course, there's the actual play on the field and who could go all the way. Predicting a winner for the World Cup? Not easy. Look, I put a bet on Cameroon to win their opener in the 1990 World Cup with 8-1 odds, and it paid off, but that was a single match wager I made with my heart, not my brain. Scientists at the University of Oxford who do use their brains think they can pick the champion. Joshua Bull is one of those researchers. He's developed a mathematical model for picking the country that will take home the FIFA trophy. He joins us from Oxford, England, to tell us about it. You typically spend your time studying cancer biology, Joshua. What prompted you to develop this mathematical model to study outcomes in, you call it football, we call it soccer?
Yeah, apologies if I slip into football on the way through. I'm a cancer researcher by day, but a few years ago, I actually won the UK version of fantasy football. And that got me really interested in the statistics behind football and the kind of maths behind trying to predict these kind of improbable events that we see in football sometimes.
Explain how it works. What factors does your model use and take into consideration?
Yeah, so the two main things that I've been looking at are something called XG, which is the expected number of goals that a team will score. And I've been comparing that with the team ratings. So to try and work out, a strong team plays a weaker team, can we adjust their kind of expected number of goals to take account of that relative strength?
And when you're looking at teams, is it simply the number of goals and their overall ratings that you're looking at?
So the number of goals is a very noisy statistic, but it's actually not necessarily very predictive. So actually looking at the quality of the shots that they're taking within a game gives you a better predictive value than actually looking at what the result was. So sometimes the better team might lose. So you really want to look at those kind of underlying statistics to try and take into account the quality of the team rather than what the result happened to be.
And what about individual player statistics, like that great true story depicted in the movie Moneyball? How much do those player performance stats matter in your model?
In real life, they're incredibly important. In my model, I don't actually use them at all.
Why not? It would seem to be really important.
I mean, the biggest thing for me of why I didn't include them is because I thought there was too much uncertainty in who was going to be in which team. So obviously, the quality of an individual player can be really important. But if they're not in the game, you don't want to be assuming that they will be. So the wonderful thing about XG is that it accounts for the quality of all of the shots that a team gets in a game. regardless of who they've got on the pitch.
And if you did know for sure the roster of the country's team, like you knew that these specific players were to show up, would that make a difference in your modeling?
It would. The problem that I've got is that it's really hard to get hold of detailed data for each of those players.
So I got to get us to cut to the chase here. Who's going to win the World Cup and what were the main predictive factors?
So my money would be on Brazil. I've got Brazil and Argentina head and shoulders above everyone else, actually. So Brazil winning about 14.5% of the time, Argentina about 14%.
I mean, even when countries don't go all the way, advancing far into the World Cup can stoke large amounts of national pride. What about your native England, Joshua? How do you predict they'll fare?
Well, so this is where I think my model is underestimating us. So I have us finishing 11th highest chance of winning. And I think the most common outcome is that we end up in the quarterfinals and then get knocked out there. But I think my model is using some recent data a bit too strongly. So England this year have had a few very unfortunate results to kind of weaker teams. And I think that's made them drop quite a long way in the rankings that I've been using.
Although quarterfinals wouldn't be shabby.
It wouldn't be too bad. I'd be fairly happy with that. But at the end of the day, the underdog can always win, and that's why we love it.
Mm. And what about the US? Any predictions there?
My most common outcome has them finishing bottom of the group, but it is very close, actually, between the US, Wales, and Iran. So they could well make it out.
I'm curious, have you gotten any response from soccer fans about the predictions?
Most people who are doing kind of statistical ticks on soccer have said, yes, there's nothing that looks egregiously wrong here. Their predictions are coming up with similar teams at the top. But by and large, the response has been great. People seem to really like it.
So how confident are you in your Brazil prediction, Joshua? When are you heading down to Ladbrokes to place your bet?
I've not put any money on Brazil, I have to say. I did put a cheeky bet on the Netherlands just because the odds that the bookies were offering was far better than what my model was saying. So I thought, well, it's always worth a chance.
Joshua Bull is a research scientist using mathematical models to study cancer biology at the University of Oxford. And that knowledge has led him to come up with a mathematical model to predict the winner of the World Cup in Qatar. Joshua joined us from Oxford. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If statistical analysis is a bit too brainy, there are other ways to forecast the winner of the World Cup, like animals flexing their predictive abilities. Mystic Millie, a purportedly psychic camel in England, is off to a strong start. The Sun tabloid presented her with paper flags from England and Iran, and Millie correctly chose her countrymen to win. England took care of Iran 6-2 earlier today. Millie is not the first camel to get in the predictions game. Shaheen the camel had a good run during the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. Shaheen watched from Dubai and correctly chose 7 of 8 teams in the knockout round. Shaheen, though, had nothing on Paul the octopus. Based in his aquarium in Germany, Paul had an 85% overall success rate during the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, an unrivaled record among animal clairvoyants. Paul would drape himself over a box in his tank that represented the competing teams and let one of his 8 tentacles dangle next to Spain to win, beating out Germany and turning a nation of adoring fans immediately against him. It's a burden being right, isn't it, Paul? You're listening to The World. When Brazil takes to the soccer pitch this week at the World Cup, you'll see the country's iconic yellow jerseys everywhere. That shirt has taken on added significance after Brazil's recent presidential election.
Essa camisa é nossa!
The shirt is ours, says a supporter of the newly elected president. The battle over Brazil's yellow jersey still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. As Ukrainian forces liberate areas that were under Russian occupation, they're also discovering atrocities committed by the Russian military. Several mass graves have been found. The largest one was in the city of Izyum. The World's Shirin Jafari recently visited the site and spoke with investigators trying to piece together what happened.
Right, we just arrived at the mass burial site in Izyum. About 450 people were buried here. The graves have been exhumed, so there are no bodies here, but you can still see the places where they dug up the bodies, and some have crosses on them and some just have numbers. 146, 189. that's all some of the dead got. It's really eerie here.
This site is in a forested area just outside of the city. Tall pine trees surround the graves. A pile of used masks and blue gloves is a reminder that this is a crime scene still under investigation. Russian troops arrived in Izyum in March. The city was heavily bombarded. Thousands of residents left. But many couldn't leave. They were older, didn't have the means to get out, or they decided to stay behind and fight. The Russian occupation lasted 6 months. Dmytro Leontiev tells me that his father, Nikolai, was among those who stayed here. He says the 65-year-old had some health problems. Dmytro's wife, Olena, says that bombs were raining down on the city, so Nikolai and his wife moved into the basement. Luckily, they'd managed to stock up on groceries before the takeover, so they had some food, she says. But Nikolai's health quickly deteriorated, and on March 20th, he died. Dmytro says his last phone call to his father was about 2 weeks before that. We heard in his voice that he wasn't well, Olena says. It was cold there. There was no one to help him. Hospitals weren't working. The fighting made it impossible for Dmytro and Olena to get to Izyum. Neighbors buried Nikolai in the backyard. But one day, Russian soldiers showed up and removed his body. They said the grave wasn't dug deep enough. And that's where the mystery begins. No one knows what happened to Nikolai's body after that. Dmytro says he thinks the Russian soldiers dumped the body in the mass burial site, the one I visited earlier. But given that many of the graves had no name, he's not sure, and he wants some answers. When I meet with Dmytro and his wife, they're outside a mobile laboratory in Izyum. The lab was set up with the help of the French government. About 24 people have lined up outside to have DNA samples taken. All of them, like Dmytro, have missing relatives. The goal here is to help identify human remains exhumed from the mass grave. Technicians swab the mass of the relatives to collect saliva. They then compare DNA samples to a database created with samples taken from the burial site. Alexander Filchakov is the head of Kharkiv's regional prosecutor's office. He tells me that at least 17 of the 451 bodies found in the mass grave showed evidence of torture. Some had ropes tied around their necks, hands tied behind their backs, and cracked bones. His office is currently working on about 8,000 war crime cases, all from this part of Ukraine. They range from destruction of civilian infrastructure to intentional torture and murder of civilians. Filchakov says Russian troops have essentially been trying to erase Ukrainian identity.
Балаклія, от видите, Яковенка. Там з нами вилучені відповідні документи.
In the town of Balaklia, he says, the occupiers confiscated school textbooks and replaced them with Russian ones. Filchakov says it will take years to investigate all of these war crime cases, and some families might never find out what happened to their loved ones. That's little comfort to Ludmila Voshana, who is searching for her son's body. Edward was 31 years old, and when the war began, he volunteered with the Territorial Defense Forces. Voshana says she lost touch with Edward on March 6. 4 days later, she says there was an airstrike that killed him, but his fellow fighters could not find his body. We lost everything, and that's okay. I just wish I could find my son, she says, as she waits outside the DNA collection lab. This is the most important thing. The mobile lab has been used in other locations in Ukraine, for example in Bucha, north of Kyiv, and it has identified remains and given people some certainty about what happened to their loved ones. This is one tool that investigators are using to document Russia's war crimes. I meet up with Roman Avramenko, executive director of an NGO called Truth Hounds, at his office in Kyiv. The group has been collecting war crimes evidence in Ukraine since Russia's takeover of Crimea in 2014.
This expertise that we developed and gained during previous years of documenting really helped us to contribute to the justice processes a lot.
Since last March, Avramenko and his team have been crisscrossing the country, talking with witnesses, taking pictures and videos from locations where suspected war crimes took place.
We're trying to find any place we can bring those responsible to justice.
He says what they have found is grim.
The Ukrainians have been so dehumanized in the eyes of regular Russian soldiers that they see no difference between killing a cat or killing a child.
Avramenko and his team are working hard to bring these cases to Ukrainian courts, and if not here, to international courts. He says he's hopeful that someday Russians who committed crimes in his country will face justice. That's what many Ukrainians are hoping for. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Izium, Ukraine.
In Brazil, President-elect Lula da Silva will be taking office in January, and LGBTQ activists are lobbying him now to prioritize human rights. They're hoping the new president will help reverse a trend that has ranked the country among the worst places in the world for LGBTQ rights. Musician Bia Ferreira is one of those activists, and she is outspoken. On her latest album, Feminita, she celebrates, as she says, black women love. The world's April Peavy recently caught up with Bia Ferreira and brings us this profile.
Bia Ferreira gets right to the point.
It's so hard to be queer in Brazil.
There's a bit of weariness in her voice, but she's defiant.
But we're together. We're fighting. We won't give up.
Murder rates of trans and queer people in Brazil are among the highest in the world. In the last 13 years, more than 4,000 have been killed. And so Bia Ferreira, the activist and musician, is on a mission to save LGBTQ people, not in the evangelical salvation sort of way, but in an open and affirming way. Bia herself was raised in the church.
My father is a priest, and I grew up listening that I will go to the hell, and I'm a sinner, and God doesn't love me. So I create a way to hug the people that listen the same things and think that God doesn't like them, and say, if your church doesn't want you, we want you here to make a revolution with love and information for other people like us.
In 2019, Bia Ferreira released the album translated as Lesbitarian Church, A Call. Through the album, she created her own church in a way.
Don't matter to me if you are hetero, gay, lesbian, white, black, Catholic, or Buddhist. If you believe queer lives matter and contributes to a better world, if you believe in that, you make part of the Lesbitarian Church and you're welcome.
The song, Levante a Bandera, Raise the Flag, is one way to celebrate. In a country where it's not safe to be trans or queer, you'd think critics would drown out her message. But Bia has experienced the opposite.
I have a lot of people in Brazil that believes in what I say, and better than this, that say, you are saying what I cannot say. Thank you, you're saving a lot of people. Oh, thank you, I brought my father to listen to you. I brought my mother to listen to you. And now we have a good relationship. So I'm so glad to know that my words, my writing, my songs help other people like me. I appreciate.
Her parents, on the other hand, haven't yet come around.
They don't believe that I do art because I'm not singing for God. So I'm singing for the devil. But I love them a lot. We have some different ways to think, but we're family.
Despite family friction, Bia Ferreira will continue to fight for trans and queer rights. That theme continues on her new album, Faminta. For now, her fans will be the supportive family she needs. For the world, I'm April Peavy.
And this quick item from the Ancient Culture Desk, a century after the discovery of King Tut's tomb in Egypt, another big moment of the pyramids, hundreds of coffins and mummies have been unearthed in Giza, 20 miles south of Cairo. Archaeologists had been digging in the area for the past 2 years. They'd already found painted tombs and a sarcophagus. The newly found coffins have individual faces, distinguishing men from women, even names. Inside, the mummies are pretty much untouched and in good condition. The cherry on the top, the archaeologists even found a previously unknown queen named Neith. The new findings will be on display next year at the Grand Egyptian Museum in Giza. An icon of resistance in Argentina has died, Eve de Bonafini. We're talking the time between 1976 and 1983 during the country's military junta, the period known as the Dirty War, when opponents, even suspected opponents of the regime, vanished. When Eve de Bonafini's sons disappeared, she went looking for them. In her search, she met other mothers also looking for their children. Bonafini helped organize weekly Thursday marches. The mothers' white handkerchiefs, tied around their heads like a bonnet, became their symbol. International human rights lawyer Juan Mendez represented political prisoners in Argentina around that time and knew Bonafini. He joins us from Washington. Juan, describe those Thursday afternoon marches in Buenos Aires. What were they like? What was the scene?
The mothers first started going into the government house, because that's the site of the Ministry of Interior, seeking information on their children. And when they were basically told to go away and not given any information, they started very early on, while repression was still very harsh, they started going in circles around the square that's right in front of the government house. And at first it was a curiosity, but then the world started to take into consideration the fact that there were these mothers looking for their children and getting no response. Even until now, every Thursday, they continue to meet because they feel that there's still something missing. They don't have information on what happened to their children. They still seek answers from the state and from society.
Can you take us back to that time and what society felt like then?
Well, actually, I worked defending political prisoners a little earlier, but I was myself imprisoned still during the government of Isabel Martinez de Perón, when repression had already become quite serious. But the military took over when I was still in custody, and then I was allowed to go into exile, actually expelled from my own country. But obviously, after the takeover in 1976, things got a lot worse, not only inside prisons where I was. Many friends of mine are among the disappeared, including colleagues who, like me, represented political prisoners. We were still held in very bad conditions with a lot of violence and without charges in my case. Obviously, things were a lot worse for those who were taken right after the military took over and the disappearances started. They were taken to clandestine detention centers around the nation and kept there in horrible conditions, places where no judge or anybody could come and inspect. And that meant, obviously, that they could torture them to their heart's content.
Having gone through some of this yourself, Juan, do you think you kind of established some connection to the mothers, having known what the children went through there to some degree?
Well, of course. I mean, I met Evie and many other mothers of Plaza de Mayo, some of them already departed, some still fighting for truth and justice in Argentina. And I feel, quite a bond with them. Mm.
To you, Juan Mendez, what is Eve de Bonafini's lasting accomplishment?
She was a magnetic figure and a very, and sometimes a controversial one. Her role was indispensable. She brought to the attention of everybody this phenomenon of disappearances and how it opens wounds in the society and affects not only the actual victim, but also a wide circle of their families, friends, and acquaintances. So I think putting disappearances up front has meant that international law now recognizes the phenomenon in very specific ways. We are better equipped now to fight against phenomena of this sort that unfortunately happens in other countries as well.
International human rights lawyer and former UN rapporteur on torture, Juan Mendez. We were talking about the death of human rights activist Hebe de Bonafini in Argentina. She was 93. Juan, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thank you for calling me.
In Kenya, drivers for ride-hailing apps are going on strike. They're citing low pay and long-standing grievances over working conditions for foreign companies. As the world's Halima Gikandi reports from Nairobi, this strike takes a new approach.
About 100 drivers are crowded into a meeting room in Nairobi. They're taking turns going up to the front to air their grievances. Today is the first day of a strike against Uber and Bolt, a European ride-hailing company. Justin Yaga of the Organization of Online Drivers tells me why they're striking. He says his organization represents about 3,000 workers.
So we decided to switch them off as a sign to show them that they should give driver a chance to speak their hearts.
Speak their hearts and listen to them. Nyaga tells me he has been using driving apps for about 8 years now. Apps like Uber are incredibly popular here in Nairobi. But he tells me the drivers are really struggling to make ends meet because of the low rates and high commissions taken by these companies.
For your family to feed well, for your children to go to school, better school, you find that you have to work extra hours, maybe from 6 in the morning to probably 11 at night.
17-hour workdays just to take home maybe $10 a day once you subtract all of the expenses and fees. Yaga tells me drivers hoped things would get better when the government passed new regulations this year, but he says Uber and Bolt are not following them.
We are not against foreign applications. If they comply and agree to meet with the driver's requirements, we are ready to continue with Uber and Bolt in good terms.
But until that happens, Nyaga and his colleagues are trying something new. They're organizing a mass migration onto Uber's competitors' apps, including local Kenyan companies. Today, they invited representatives of those companies to sign up new drivers. One of them is Mohamed Mburu. He's a driver himself and also works at Yego, a company that opened in Rwanda and entered the Kenyan market this year.
The driver gets to keep more because we only charge 12% commission as compared to our rivals who charge up to 29%. And 23%.
He tells me they already signed up 10,000 drivers in their first 6 weeks. Mburu says the company's strategy is to put drivers first.
Because they have the power. The drivers are the ones that give these companies power to exist, actually.
He said drivers have the right to earn a good living. Today, when I reached out to Uber about this strike, a spokesperson told me the company plans to continue to engage with drivers directly to address these issues. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
In Brazil, soccer is, to put it mildly, a national obsession. For many Brazilians, though, this year's World Cup feels different, coming as it does on the heels of a contentious national election. President Jair Bolsonaro, who narrowly lost his re-election bid a few weeks ago, had made the iconic yellow soccer jersey a symbol of his campaign. The result? Many Brazilians are having a hard time getting behind the national team. Michael Fox reports in Sao Paulo.
Bolsonaro rallies are a sea of yellow and green, the national colors. Brazilian flags, the national soccer jersey. This is the uniform of choice for Bolsonaro supporters looking to show their pride in the current far-right president. These colors are a symbol of how we are defending our country, a Bolsonaro supporter wearing a Brazilian soccer jersey told me outside of a polling station in October. We have a candidate who defends our country, defends the homeland and family, and the other candidate doesn't. Bolsonaro's embrace of the country's colors has divided Brazil. Gustavo Turk is a journalist in Porto Alegre.
A gente enxerga que houve sequestro da bandeira e da camiseta.
There has been a kidnapping of the flag and the shirt. Literally, there has been a kidnapping of these symbols by this political sect, he says. It has had a profound impact on the way Brazilians see their national imagery. My daughter is nine. It's her second World Cup, he says. But today, she sees the flag or the Brazilian soccer jersey, and she immediately identifies it with Bolsonaro. That is by design. Bolsonaro is not the first Brazilian leader to appropriate the country's symbols.
Atenção, Brasil! As tropas...
Brazil's military dictatorship of the 1960s and 70s strategically used the flag and the Brazilian soccer jersey to generate unity around the regime. Carolina Botelho is a political scientist at the University of São Paulo.
Os militares brasileiros utilizavam...
The Brazilian military used these symbols as a way of showing patriotism, and the people who were against this were seen as enemies of the state, she says. Bolsonaro has long praised the military dictatorship and even called for its return. And that has led many of his opponents to reject the flag, the colors, and the national soccer jersey. But the re-election of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in late October could change that. This shirt is ours, an ecstatic Lula supporter told me in Sao Paulo on election night. He wore a Brazilian soccer jersey bearing Lula's image. It's the shirt of Brazil and the Brazilian people, he said. It's Lula.
Meus amigos e minhas amigas, o Brasil está completando 200 anos de...
During the campaign, Lula said the yellow and green should represent all Brazilians, not just one group. Marcelo Igiarchi is a blogger and an avid soccer fan who says he hasn't worn the national jersey for years because of what it's come to represent. Happily, since Lula won, we'll be able to use it again. People already are, he says. But it's a process. It won't be immediate. Sports historian Carolina Fernandes da Silva says the World Cup could help. It could get others to use the colors, but the election is still very recent, she says, as are the illegal protests of Bolsonaro supporters calling for military intervention and trying to undermine the vote. Brazil's top player, Neymar, also did not help. He avidly backed Bolsonaro for the presidency this year. Just ahead of the first round vote, this video went viral over social media. It shows him dancing to one of Bolsonaro's campaign songs. But some Lula supporters can see beyond that. Alex Brazil is a doctor who attended a Lula rally in late October with a green Brazilian flag draped over his shoulders.
A bandeira é um símbolo nacional e ela não representa nenhum partido.
The flag is a national symbol. It doesn't represent one party. It represents us all, regardless of political party or ideology, he said. So taking back the flag is to rescue Brazil. It's to rescue our democracy. Lula's election just ahead of the World Cup has opened a window where we will likely see more Brazilians embracing the national jersey than at any time in recent years. But the emotions around Brazil's iconic shirt will continue to be complicated. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe and stay strong, everyone. We'll see you back here tomorrow.